emergency 911 operator 6752. Do you need police, fire, or ambulance?
Maybe an ambulance.
What's wrong, ma'am?
We had someone that was in our house, evidently, and they stabbed somebody.
Okay, somebody's inside the house now?
I don't know. We heard.
Are they bleeding? You see someone bleeding?
Someone is bleeding in our house.
Okay, where are they bleeding from?
I think in the stomach.
In the stomach? Is he conscious? Calm down for me. I'm going to send some help, okay? Female or male?
It's a male. He's a friend of ours. He's spending the night with us.
Okay, and who was the person that stabbed him? Do you know? Is he conscious?
We need an ambulance.
Ma'am, listen to me.
He's not conscious.
He's not conscious at all?
No. We need someone right now.
Is he breathing? Listen to me. Calm down. I'm going to help you, okay? Is he breathing?
I'm upstairs, and he's downstairs. I don't know.
Okay, who's downstairs with him?
My partner is downstairs with him right now. He told me to go upstairs and call the police immediately.
Okay, who's the person? Okay, I'm sending paramedics and the police. Okay, who's the person that stabbed him?
I don't know. We think it's somebody with an intruder in the house. We heard the chime at the door.
And it's 15, ma'am, calm down. 1509 Swan Street Northwest, am I correct?
Yes, it is.
The person that stabbed him, is he still in the home?
I don't know.
On the evening of August 2nd, 2006, a 32-year-old lawyer was finishing up work at his office at Radio Free Asia in Washington, D.C. His commute home was long. He lived outside of the city in Oakton, Virginia with his wife, Kathy, and he had had a long day. Rather than try to get home via public transportation at 9:30, he'd made arrangements with a college friend, a lawyer named Joseph Price, to stay in the guest room at his DuPont Circle home. Within 2 hours of arriving at Price's $1.2 million townhouse, this young lawyer was dead, and the circumstances surrounding his death were baffling. Price and the two other people living in the home, Victor Zaborski and Dylan Ward, were the last people to see this young lawyer alive. But getting the truth out of them would prove to be a Herculean task for investigators. This is the story of Robert One. Robert One was born the eldest of two sons to parents William and Amy on June 1st, 1971, in Brooklyn, New York. A fourth-generation Chinese-American, his great-grandparents immigrated from China to the US in the 1930s. The family had lived in New York ever since. Kind and competent, Robert was a bright kid who made friends easy, the kind of guy who snuck out of his college dorm room at night to scrub school statues clean of bird scat. Someone who put change into random parking meters so that the stranger would not get a parking ticket. He seemed to do good deeds just for the sake of doing them. To describe Robert as promising would be an understatement. After being accepted as a top applicant to the College of William and Mary in Virginia, he worked as an aide to the president of the university. He folded seamlessly into a strong clique of equally promising friends. There he met Joseph Price, an ambitious future lawyer, who turned into a lifelong friend after the pair revamped a campus secret society called the 13 Club, which performed covert acts of kindness. After graduating with his bachelor's degree in 1996, Robert went on to obtain a law degree from the University of Pennsylvania in 1999. Soon thereafter, he landed a job with the prestigious law firm Covington & Burling, and became a rising star within the Asian American legal community. At a legal conference in January of 2002, he met his future wife, Catherine Yu. Catherine, or Kathy, as she is known by friends and family, was the daughter of Korean immigrants and grew up in Chicago. Kathy had her own slate of academic achievements as well as a promising career as a lawyer. After the conference, she and Robert started a long-term relationship that quickly turned serious. Within a year, Robert proposed. She moved to Washington, D.C., and they were wed in 2003. It was the beginning of a blissful and loving marriage. By 2006, they had it all. Careers they loved, friends who cared, and bright futures ahead of them. Unfortunately, the ones would not get the happy ending they were hoping for. By early summer of 2006, Robert One knew he wanted something more out of life. He was prospering as a young lawyer at the Covington & Burling law firm in Washington, D.C., but his desire to be of service to his community was strong. He told his wife, Kathy, that he wanted to try for a position as the General Counsel for Radio Free Asia, a nonprofit American news organization aimed at supplying uncensored media content to underserved and oppressed communities in Asia. It almost certainly meant a severe decrease in Robert's salary if he accepted this job, but Kathy was all in. She wanted him to be happy and fulfilled with his work. She had a good job at a healthcare consulting firm. They would be just fine. So, Robert went through the interview process and, unsurprisingly, landed the job. By early August of 2006, he was settling into his new role. On August 2nd, Robert made arrangements to stay overnight in Washington, D.C. There was a nighttime legal seminar he was excited to attend, and afterward, he wanted to go back to the Radio Free Asia offices and introduce himself to the second shift staff. He and Kathy talked it over, and both agreed that staying overnight in DC would be easier than trying to make the long trip home via public transportation back to their condo in Oakton, Virginia. It just so happened that a dear friend of Robert's from college, a person that Kathy also knew very well, lived in a prime location off of DuPont Circle, Robert's old friend, Joseph Price. Joe Price met Robert One in college when they both attended William and Mary. He graduated in 2003 and went on to get his law degree from the University of Virginia. Joe Price was very active in the gay community, and when he graduated from UVA, he became the president of the Gay and Lesbian Alumni Association. By 2006, Price had made partner at Arent Fox, a high-powered national law firm with offices in Washington, D.C. It was clear that life was going well for him. In addition to his career heights, Price was also in a long-term committed relationship with Victor Zaborski, a senior marketing manager for Milk PEP, or Milk Processors Education Program, i.e., the people responsible for the famous Got Milk campaigns of the early 2000s. The partners fathered two sons with a lesbian couple and seemed to be pillars of the gay community. By 2004, they had brought a second man into their relationship, Dylan Ward, a Georgetown graduate who seemed to bounce around into different careers. The three of them moved into a $1.2 million townhouse off of DuPont Circle. They described themselves as a family and maintained a polyamorous relationship with one another, though some assert that Joe was considered the patriarch of the clan. The three of them hosted Robert One's 30th birthday party in 2004, and shared a close friendship with both Robert and Kathy. Joe and Victor had even gone to the One's wedding in 2003. So, when Robert brought up the possibility of staying in Price's townhome on the evening of August 2nd, 2006, Kathy had absolutely no issue. The Ones started their day on August 2nd just like any other. They went to the gym by their home in Oakton before riding the metro together into Washington, D.C. They parted with a kiss before heading to their respective offices. When they both arrived at their offices, they emailed each other that they were safe and sound, a daily habit. After work, Robert grabbed a sandwich and headed to a continuing education legal seminar. That ended at around 9:30 p.m., and he called Kathy while in the cab, heading back to his office to meet with the night staff at Radio Free Asia. After that, he told her he would hail a cab to take him to Joe Price's and then go to bed. That was the last time she heard her husband's voice. At 12:06 a.m., Kathy got a shocking phone call from Joseph Price. "Kathy," he said, "I can't believe I'm calling you about this. Go over to George Washington Hospital. Robert has been stabbed in the back." Kathy immediately called her in-laws. They had just moved to the area from Brooklyn in order to be closer to them. Robert's younger brother was also in town on a visit. The entire family rode over to George Washington Hospital expecting to find Robert in critical condition, but when they got there, he was already dead. Furthermore, Robert had been stabbed in the chest and stomach, not in the back as Joe Price had indicated. Perhaps Kathy did not think much of it at the time, but this was just the first in a long line of discrepancies that would eventually lead to a bizarre and frustrating murder investigation into the death of her husband.
DC Emergency 911, operator 6752, do you need police, fire, or ambulance?
Immediately, I'm needing an ambulance.
What's wrong, ma'am?
We had someone that was in our house, evidently, and they stabbed somebody.
Okay, somebody's inside the house now?
I don't know, we heard.
Are they bleeding? You see someone bleeding?
Someone is bleeding in our house.
Okay, where's they bleeding from?
I think in the stomach.
In the stomach? Is he conscious? Calm down for me. I'm going to send some help, okay? Female or male?
It's a male. He's a friend of ours. He's spending the night with us.
Okay, and who was the person that stabbed him? Do you know? Is he conscious?
We need an ambulance.
Ma'am, listen to me.
He's not conscious.
He's not conscious at all?
No. We need someone right now.
Is he breathing? Listen to me. Calm down. I'm going to help you, okay? Is he breathing?
I'm upstairs, and he's downstairs. I don't know.
Okay, who's downstairs with him?
My partner is downstairs with him right now. He told me to go upstairs and call the police immediately. I just went to the stairs.
Okay, who's the person? Okay, I'm sending paramedics and the police. Okay, who's the person that stabbed him?
I don't know. We think it's somebody with an intruder in the house. We heard the chime at the door.
And it's 15, ma'am, calm down. 1509 Swan Street Northwest, am I correct?
Yes, it is.
The person that stabbed him, is he still in the home?
I don't know.
We got help and route, okay?
Pardon me?
We have help and route.
Thank you. They're
okay.
Here.
They are en route to you now. I'm sending the police and the paramedics, okay, to assist. Okay, what I need you to do is go downstairs, okay? The place wherever he was stabbed at, I need you to get a dry cloth, okay? And just apply pressure to that area. If he was wherever he was stabbed at on his body, I need you to take a towel downstairs while you're waiting for the paramedics to arrive and just apply pressure. Even if the rag or towel is saturated with blood, just get another towel and put it on top, but never lift the first towel off the area. Hold it on. Once it gets filled up with blood, just put another towel on top of that and just apply pressure until the paramedics arrive.
Pressure until the paramedics on the
leg. Yes.
With
stab
in the heart.
In the heart?
Yes. In the center of his chest.
Okay. Is he breathing?
Is he breathing?
We have help and route now, okay? You don't know who it was?
No idea. Don't touch.
Okay, is he breathing?
He's breathing, but
he
needs help now.
Okay, we have help and route, ma'am, okay? We do have help and route. Okay, just go down there and try to tell your husband or your other the other half to just try to keep him calm and talk to him, okay? Keep him calm and talk to him until someone gets there.
Okay.
And at the same time, get a dry cloth and just hold it right there in the area.
My partner's holding the...
Okay.
Holding it on him.
Okay, and once it gets saturated with blood, tell him get another one. Go get another towel so you can apply it on top of that one once it gets filled up with blood.
Okay,
we need you to apply pressure on that area.
He is applying pressure right now.
Okay, just hold it there until the paramedics get there. They should be pulling up any moment. If they're already en route to your location, you don't know who did this.
We have no idea who did this.
At 11:49 p.m. on the evening of August 2nd, 2006, a 911 dispatcher in Washington, D.C. received a call from Victor Zaborski at 1509 Swan Street Northwest. He was crying and frantic as he told the operator they needed an ambulance at the residence. He said an intruder had been inside his house evidently and stabbed a friend of theirs who had been staying the night. Is someone bleeding? The dispatcher asked. Yes, Victor replied. Where is he bleeding from? She asked. His stomach, Victor said. The dispatcher then asked him if the person was breathing, and Victor said he did not know. At that point, the 911 operator sounded confused. Who was with him? Victor said his partner, Joe Price, was with the victim down on the second floor where he had been stabbed, that he, Victor, had gone upstairs to call the police. Do you know who did this? The woman asked repeatedly. Victor responded pretty definitively, "We have no idea who did this." The dispatcher told Victor that paramedics were en route and to go downstairs and apply pressure to the knife wound with a towel. Her instructions were very specific, and she repeated herself several times. Get a towel, apply pressure. When that towel fills up with blood, apply another one on top of it. Do not remove the initial towel. In the background of the call, Victor can be heard telling someone to apply pressure to the wound. Victor had described a gut wound, and possibly a heart wound as well. The dispatcher knew that meant buckets of blood. Massive blood loss from knife wounds to the abdomen was completely normal, but nothing about this case was normal, and when paramedics arrived minutes later, one of them said the scene they walked into, quote, made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. The 911 operator told Victor to go open the door for the paramedics, and as Victor made his way downstairs, he volunteered the information that the killer must have run out of the house with one of their knives. She asked him again if he knew who did this, and he replied that he had no idea.
Get the door open so they can get in.
We don't know how they got in.
Okay, well, I'm asking you now, get the door open so the paramedics can get in once they get here.
What? Sorry. What were you saying?
Get the door open so they can get in. Get the door open so the paramedics can get in the home.
I'm going to go down.
Is this a private home or apartment?
It's a home.
It's a home. It's 1509 what? Swan Street Northwest.
The person had one of my knives.
The person that stabbed him ran out the door with a knife?
I think
so. Okay, anybody get any type of description of the person that came in the home?
I have no idea. We have no description. We heard the chime. And we heard the scream from our friend.
Okay.
And so we came running downstairs. We ran in.
So you both was upstairs and your friend was downstairs?
Yes.
You heard the door open and then you heard the scream.
I didn't hear the door open until after the scream. And then we ran down the stairs and we have an alarm. And so the chime went off.
Okay.
Is the ambulance, please, we really need the ambulance.
Okay, they're in route now, ma'am. Go to the door. They should be pulling up any moment, okay?
I'm afraid to go downstairs.
Okay, the person who's downstairs was the person that was assaulted.
No, we're on the second floor.
Okay, so somebody need to go downstairs and open the door for the paramedics. You're not sure if that person's still in the home or not.
I have no idea.
Okay, we have paramedics in route, okay?
What time is it?
What time is it at the moment?
Yes.
23:54. It's 11:54, ma'am.
11:54.
Yes.
I mean...
I'll stay on the line with you. I will stay on the line until somebody gets here, okay? I won't hang up.
We need them right now. I'm not hanging up, but we need help now.
Okay, they en route, ma'am. They are en route. Let me know when you hear the paramedics. Can you look out the window and see if you hear them coming?
I'm looking out the window, and I see nothing. I see nobody.
Okay, it seems like forever, but they are en route, ma'am. They're coming.
Here they are.
They're there.
I'm going downstairs.
Okay. I'll stay on the line with you till you open the door for the paramedics, okay?
Help us. We have someone with stabbed. They're on our second floor. Oh, man.
Ma'am.
No, it's really an emergency. I mean, he may be. Please hurry.
Ma'am, it's gonna be okay.
The paramedics arrived at the scene at 11:54 p.m., 5 minutes after Victor had placed the call. He was on the porch wearing a white terry cloth bathrobe, still on the phone with the 911 operator. He pleaded for the paramedics to help, said that the stabbing victim was on the second floor, and then started to sob uncontrollably. The two paramedics had 25 years of experience combined, and what they found inside the house alarmed even them. Usually, when they had responded to a stabbing or a shooting, occupants of the house were screaming and directing the paramedics to the victim. Pure chaos. The people at this scene, however, with the exception of Victor on the porch, appeared calm and serene. As they went up the stairs, they encountered another inhabitant of the house, Dylan Ward, coming out of a hallway bathroom on the second floor. He was freshly showered and wearing a robe. The paramedics asked him what was going on, but he did not acknowledge them. Instead, he walked right past the paramedics into a bedroom and closed the door. The paramedics continued down the hall to the guest room, where they found the body of 32-year-old Robert One lying on a fully made pull-out sofa bed. No one was attempting to hold a towel over his stab wounds. The house's owner, Joseph Price, was seated on the bed in his underwear with his back to the door. The paramedics again asked what was going on, and Joe Price simply replied, without turning around, that he had heard a scream. The paramedics later stated that Price's behavior was so eerie that they looked at his hands to see if he had a weapon on him, and positioned themselves in such a way that they could both attend to Robert One while keeping an eye on Joe Price. Robert was found lying with his head on a pillow and his hands down at his sides. His sleeping mouthguard, used to keep him from grinding his teeth, still nestled snugly between them. He was wearing a gray William and Mary t-shirt and had been stabbed 3 times in the front of his torso through the shirt. One of the paramedics described the heart wound as gaping, so big you could fit your finger in it. There was a knife with a light smearing of blood sitting on the bedside table. Presumably, the murder weapon. Robert One had no pulse, and the paramedics knew he had been dead for some time. They performed an EKG on him that resulted in a flat line, indicating no activity in his heart. They transported him to the hospital, where he was officially pronounced dead at 12:25 a.m. Robert One had arrived at the flat Joseph Price shared with Victor Zaborski and Dylan Ward at 10:30 p.m. that night. And by 12:25 a.m. on August 3rd, he was dead. What had transpired? Who had killed him? And why did the crime scene look so bizarre? Police had many questions to answer, and they wasted no time in questioning the last 3 people to see Robert One alive. Now, we are going to pause for just a moment to hear a word from today's sponsors. The Metropolitan Police Department arrived on the scene before the paramedics had taken Robert One's body to the hospital. They noted the guest room was neat and orderly. There was no sign of a struggle, and nothing was out of place. Robert's work clothes were neatly folded at the foot of his bed, and his wallet, BlackBerry, and expensive watch were lying undisturbed on a table nearby. If robbery had been the motive, the thief missed the mark. Everything indicated to investigators that there had been no struggle. Robert's pillow had one indentation from his head, just as if he had laid his head down and not moved throughout the entire attack. Save for a light blood smear that looked as though it had been intentionally wiped across the skin of his abdomen, Robert One had almost no blood on his body. This was exceedingly odd for someone with 2 stab wounds to the stomach and 1 to the chest. Stranger still, except for 2 small blood stains on the sheets beneath Robert's body, there was almost no blood on the bed either. The sheet was folded down at a 45-degree angle, just like you would see at a 5-star hotel, and Robert was almost completely clean. Officers said that the body looked as though it had been showered, redressed, and placed in the bed. Police confirmed that the knife on the bedside table came from a knife block in the kitchen, but they doubted it was the murder weapon. For one, the blade was longer than the entry wounds in Robert's chest. Blood was completely absent from the cutting edge of the knife, as were any cotton fibers from Robert's t-shirt. Police did discover a cutlery set in a cabinet in Dylan Ward's room. The set was missing a 4.5-inch knife, which would have been consistent with the depth of Robert's stab wounds. That knife has never been found. On the floor by the bed, police found a white cotton towel with three bloodstains. The three men at the scene alleged that this was the towel they had used to put pressure onto Robert's wounds, but the stains measured approximately 2.5 by 3 inches, hardly the amount of blood you would expect to find on a towel used to stop the bleeding from a knife wound. In fact, the stains looked like ones you might find on a towel after wiping blood off of a knife. Everything about the scene was wrong. None of the forensic evidence matched with what the men were saying to police. Officers took Ward, Price, and Zaborski to the police station and interviewed them separately, but they all had the same story. Robert 1 arrived at the Price, Zaborski, and Ward home at around 10:30 p.m. via taxi. At the time, Victor Zaborski, having just returned home from a business trip, was already upstairs in bed watching the television show Project Runway. Ward and Price allegedly stood in the kitchen with One, drank water, and chatted for a few minutes before they showed Robert to his guest room. Price went to the third floor master bedroom that he shared with Zaborski and went to bed. Ward said he went to his bedroom on the second floor shortly thereafter, read for about 5 minutes, and then took a sleeping pill and went to bed. He said that he heard Robert take a shower in the hallway bathroom, and then he heard the guest room door close and latch. After everyone went to sleep, Price and Zaborski said they were awakened by the door chime. Their house on Swan Street apparently had an alarm system that made a sound whenever the exterior doors were opened. They told police that they weren't concerned because they figured it might have just been their fourth roommate, Sarah, returning home for the night. Then, they heard a series of low grunts or screams, and Price and Zaborski said they jumped out of bed and ran down to the second floor, where they found Robert's guest room door ajar and him lying on the bed bleeding from stab wounds. They said neither of them heard another door chime or heard anyone running down the stairs. Price told Zaborski to go upstairs and call 911, and he knelt beside Robert and tried to stop the bleeding. He told police that he found the murder weapon lying on Robert's stomach and picked it up and placed it on the side table. Oddly, Price told police they might find his DNA on the knife because he had moved it, but they might not find the real killer's DNA because he had probably used gloves. Price told police that he did not see Ward until after he had sent Zaborski upstairs to call 911. Zaborski corroborated this by saying he did not see Ward when they initially found Robert, but that he had come out of his bedroom by the time he came back downstairs on the phone with 911. All three men agreed that an intruder must have come into the house and murdered Robert, and suggested that the perpetrator might have climbed over the security fence behind the house and entered through the back door. Investigators doubted this theory very much. For one, analysis of the fence showed the area had not been disturbed. There were cobwebs and dust that would have been tussled had someone roughly climbed over it. Also, nothing was taken from the home, and there was expensive electronic equipment all over the place. The intruder would have had to bypass Dylan Ward's room on the second floor and head straight to the guest room to kill Robert One, indicating the murderer would have had to know Robert was in the house that night. The only people that knew Robert was there was his wife Kathy and the three other people inside the home, Price, Zaborski, and Ward. Police brought in cadaver dogs trained to locate evidence of blood and decaying flesh. Other than the small amount found on Robert's bed, the only other traces of blood located in the house were found in the dryer lint trap on the second floor next to Dylan Ward's room, and near an outside drain on the back patio. Perhaps someone had washed blood off of themselves on the patio, and then dried their clothes on the second floor. According to a quote from official documents, "By all accounts and evidence, Price, Zaborski, and Ward have a very close relationship and clearly have the motive to preserve and protect the interest of one another." Each of the men gave police information about their relationship to one another and the living arrangements within 1509 Swan Street. Zaborski told investigators that he and Price had been in a committed relationship for many years, and they had brought Dylan into the relationship about 4 years prior. Dylan was in a sexual relationship with Joe Price, but not with Zaborski. Police found various items related to BDSM sex play in Dylan's room, including shackles, gags, restraints, and a host of other toys. The men explained that Dylan and Joe were in a dominant, submissive sexual relationship, in which Dylan was the dominant and Joe the submissive. They also found a device commonly referred to as a milking machine, designed to be placed on a man's penis and force him to ejaculate. This became especially pertinent to the police's theory about what happened following the autopsy of Robert One's body. Dr. Lois Goslinowski autopsied Robert One's body the day after he was stabbed on August 3rd. She found three symmetrical stab wounds in Robert's torso and discovered a broken blood vessel in his eye, indicating he had been smothered in addition to being stabbed. She determined all of the stab wounds had been made with the same roughly 4.5-inch blade, and each wound was between 4 to 5 inches deep. This effectively removed the possibility that the knife found at the crime scene was the murder weapon. In addition to the knife wounds, Dr. Goslinowski found several other strange things on Robert's body. She noticed several needle marks on his neck, right foot, and left hand that had all been inflicted before he died. She ran a routine drug scan, all of which came back negative, but unfortunately she did not test for any paralytic agents, and none of Robert One's blood was preserved prior to his burial. There was no indication that Robert had put up any kind of a struggle. Any and all defensive wounds were completely absent from his hands, arms, and legs. It was as though he had just laid there, unmoving, throughout the entire attack. She also performed a rape kit on his body, swabbing his anus, the inside of his penis, his rectum, and his mouth. The lab found semen present in each cavity, but strangely, all of the DNA found belonged to Robert One. Based on Dr. Goslinowski's findings and the limited evidence collected at the scene, police surmised that Robert One was attacked, incapacitated with some sort of paralytic agent, sexually assaulted, and stabbed to death on the night of August 2nd. More troubling, police found a gap in the official timeline. A neighbor had heard a scream come from the townhouse while they were watching the nightly news. Though they could not pinpoint the exact time they heard this scream, the program was on TV from 11 to 11:30. Victor Zaborski did not place the 911 call until 11:49 p.m., meaning there was at least a 19-minute gap between when they discovered the body and when they called the police. The problem was, police had no concrete evidence to point to who actually committed the crime, and Price, Zaborski, and Ward were no longer cooperating with investigators. They had hired attorneys right after their initial police questioning. The day after the murder, Joseph Price, Victor Zaborski, and Dylan Ward all went to Kathy One's house to pay their respects to their friend's widow. They all grieved together. Kathy had no idea how fishy their stories were. Joseph Price even served as a pallbearer at Robert's funeral. But as more information came to light, and it became clear that the three men living in 1509 Swan Street weren't telling everything they knew, distance grew between them and Kathy One. 2 weeks after the murder, police released a statement saying they believed the crime scene had been altered. The document, which was first reported in the Legal Times, included the following quote: "Technicians were able to determine that the crime scene had been tampered with, including that the area where the victim's body was located had been cleaned." But by the one-year anniversary, police were still no closer to understanding the crime or learning who had killed Robert. Kathy One and her attorney, Eric Holder, who had worked with Robert at his former law firm and coincidentally later served as President Barack Obama's attorney general, held a press conference to commemorate the anniversary and tried to get the investigation moving again. Holder confronted Price, Ward, and Zaborski directly, stating, "For those in 1509 Swan Street, where Robert was killed, you need to truly ask yourselves, truly, truly ask yourselves, have I provided the police with all the information that might be relevant to the investigation of this crime? Only you, your conscience, and your God know the answer to that question. But that is the question you must ask yourselves if you care about Robert, if you truly care about his family, if you care about Kathy. Come forward and share all of the information that you have." If anyone thought that rousing speech would loosen the three men's tongues, they were sadly mistaken. But by November of 2008, DC prosecutors had had enough. They charged all three of the men with obstruction of justice. First, Dylan Ward, then Joseph Price, and Victor Zaborski. 6 days later, on November 25th, 2008, Kathy One filed a $20 million civil suit, alleging that her husband's three friends had done nothing to help him after he had been stabbed, and instead spent the last moments of Robert's life covering up a sinister crime. The criminal case went to trial about a year and a half later in the summer of 2010. Despite all of the suspicious circumstantial evidence against the defendants, Judge Lynn Leibovitz said she did not believe beyond a reasonable doubt that they had committed obstruction of justice. She told the court that she absolutely believed that Ward, Price, and Zaborski all knew who had killed Robert One, but she ultimately acquitted them of the charges. In August of 2011, Kathy One settled her civil suit with the three men for an undisclosed amount. She explained her decision to a Washington Post reporter. "I am moving on. I want to spend the next 40 years of my life focusing on good. They can rot from the inside out from all the secrets they chose to keep. That's their choice. I chose to move on." Police don't have a concrete theory as to who was responsible for Robert One's murder, but they do have suspicions. The brother of Joseph Price, Michael, was notorious for getting into trouble. 3 months after Robert's murder, Joe Price's townhouse was burglarized, and it was revealed that Michael Price was one of the perpetrators. The charges were eventually dropped, but police looked into where Michael was on the night of the murder. It turned out Michael, who was taking college courses at Montgomery College, missed the class he had scheduled the night of August 2nd, 2006. Acquaintances of the Prices told police that Joseph always tried to help his brother out of whatever trouble he was in. If Michael had assaulted and killed Robert One, it stands to reason that Joseph would alter the crime scene to keep Michael from going to prison. No conclusive evidence exists to prove this, however. It is also possible that any other combination of things happened, carried out by the other three men inside of the home on the evening of Robert's murder. While I typically refrain from leveling accusations at people that haven't been named by police as suspects or charged, the stories of these three men, Price, Zaborski, and Ward, make them incredibly suspicious. Their behavior on the night in question stands out as particularly unusual, and the details of this bizarre crime scene, just feet away from where they were supposedly sleeping, makes it hard for me to believe that they don't know what happened. The sad truth is that whatever these three men knew, they seem committed to taking to the grave with them. Unless Joseph Price, Victor Zaborski, and Dylan Ward decide to reveal what really happened when Robert One died, we will probably never know what exactly transpired in their townhouse that night. All we know is that a kind and generous soul was snuffed out for no apparent reason, and no one has been brought to justice for it. It's incredibly tragic and frustrating. Hopefully, one day, the conscience of these three men will get the better of them. Until such a time, the story of Robert One will remain unresolved. Thank you for listening to this episode of Unresolved. Research and writing for this episode was carried out by Maggie Coomer. Production was done by me, your host, Michael Whelan. The music for this episode was composed by myself through Amper Music, except for the song you're hearing now, the Unresolved theme song, written and composed by Ailsa Traves. To get a full list of sources and references, you can check out the podcast website at unresolved.me. There, each story has its own page, where you can check out our sources or follow along with a transcript of each episode. Once again, you could find that by going to unresolved.me. If you would like to help support this podcast and gain access to our exclusive archive of digital content, please head to patreon.com/unresolvedpod or search for Unresolved Pod in the Patreon app. The amazing and wonderful producers of this podcast, who support the show each month on Patreon, are Roberta Jansen, Travis Sepko, Ben Crocom, Gabriella Bromley, Brian Hall, Quill Carter, Stephen Wilson, Laura Hannon, Joe Wong, Damian Moore, Scott Meese, Marie Vangland, Scott Patzold, Astrid Nyer, Aimee McGregor, Sarah Moscaritolo, Sydney Scotton, Thomas Ahern, Marion Welsh, Patrick Loxo, Meadow Landry, Tatum Bautista, Denise Grogan, Tunia Elzinga, Sally Ranford, Rebecca O'Sullivan, Ryan Green, Jacinda Klass, Stephanie Joyner, James Weiss, Kevin McCracken, Lauren Nicole, Matthew Trawick, Sarah Rosario, and Stacy Hauser. Thank you all, and thank you to everyone listening. Your support is always appreciated, as are your podcast reviews. Until next time, I hope you all stay safe, and I will talk to you later.